This is not an industry that provides anything to our general fund of any substance.
The Senate votes to get rid of the state's film tax credit program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 13th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a Republican lawmaker sends a questionable email on Medicaid expansion.
And I'm thinking, I know doggone well she didn't want me to get this. The NAACP is totally in agreement with expanding Medicaid.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org.
The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
With Alaska facing a multi-billion dollar revenue shortfall, lawmakers are re-examining certain subsidies to see if they should remain on the books. The film tax credit program, which was vulnerable even in times of plenty, has gotten special attention. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports the state Senate voted to dismantle the program, even as other tax credits are being considered.
If the debate over repeal of the film tax credit happened on Alaska reality television, it might play out a little like this. On one side, you have the Republican majority who thinks killing the subsidy program is a no-brainer.
You ready? Paul!
And then you have the Democratic minority fighting for the credit's survival.
What the f***? Freddie, don't do this to me!
Because the debate played out on the Alaska Senate floor instead of Sarah Palin's Alaska or Deadliest Catch, the hour spent discussing the fate of the program was not as colorful. The program was created in 2008 and has paid out nearly $50 million to documentaries, feature films, homegrown Alaska productions, and yes, reality television. Senator Bill Stoltz, a Chugiak Republican, sponsored the bill. While Stoltz has long been an opponent of the program, he presented his bill without glee and said he felt like an undertaker.
It's really just a bland fiscal issue.
Stoltz went on to say that because Alaska lacks a sales tax or a significant corporate income tax, describing the film payout as a tax credit is really a misnomer.
This is not an industry that provides anything to our general fund of any substance.
Anchorage Democrat Johnny Ellis, an architect of the film credit, rose in its defense. He dismissed the fiscal argument, pointing out that the program is already on hiatus.
The governor has suspended this program. The bill saves no state dollars. All it does is send a very negative message that Alaska is permanently closed to business and damages the hopes, dreams, and businesses of thousands of our fellow Alaskans. That's an unnecessary action to take.
Ellis said the program has helped diversify Alaska's economy and created jobs in the state. He said without it, films and TV shows that could be shot in Alaska would instead go to British Columbia or sound stages in Louisiana, where tax credits remain in place.
And it's not a stretch to remember Washington State, Sicily, Washington, playing, replacing Alaska on television in northern exposure. And $1 million a week going into another economy, and Alaskans making fun over the water cooler of all the mistakes made in that production.
As Republicans fought against the film subsidy, Democrats also used the debate to make a point about tax credits they oppose. Senator Bill Bilikowski unsuccessfully introduced a series of amendments repealing tax credits for oil companies and one refinery.
I heard sort of some people bemoan the fact that I've done this before. They're right. I have done this before. I've run this amendment very similar to this before. I'm trying to raise attention to the fact that we're paying out $431 million more in tax credits this year than we're taking in.
In a later interview, Bilikowski also noted it's ironic that the Senate was voting to dismantle the film credit program On the same day, the Alaska House of Representatives was poised to create a tax credit that would benefit a defunct fertilizer plant in Nikiski.
I think there is something poetic about it. I think it's everyone has their favorite tax credits, I guess.
The bill repealing the film credit passed 14-6. Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Bethel Democrat who caucuses with the majority, joined the minority in opposition. The bill will now be considered by the House. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A Republican lawmaker from Eagle River sent an email Friday attempting to rally opposition to Medicaid expansion. In the email obtained by KTUU, Laura Reinbold distributes the call-in number to testify at a Saturday House Finance hearing. She writes, quote, "We are trying not to get the number out to the pro-expansion, for they are much more organized," unquote. Kevin McGee was surprised to see the email in his inbox. McGee is a vice president of the NAACP Anchorage and a vocal supporter of Medicaid expansion.
And I'm thinking, I know doggone well she didn't want me to get this. The NAACP is totally in agreement with expanding Medicaid.
According to the Alaska Democratic Party, 75% of the people who testified Saturday supported Medicaid expansion. Reinbold says the email was intended to encourage people who want to, quote, preserve the fiscal future of Alaska, unquote, to have their voices heard. She says she wasn't trying to stifle debate by asking the people who received her email to withhold the call-in number from supporters of expansion.
Anybody can get that number if you call the LIO, if they can call it. It is a readily available number, but we wanted to just make sure that we were rallying the troops and getting the voices that we believe were being drowned out heard down here in Juneau.
Reinbold was kicked out of the House Majority Caucus in March after she voted against the operating budget. A poll released earlier this month by Ivan Moore Research shows 65% of Alaskans support Medicaid expansion. The overflow-affected section of the Dalton Highway between milepost 399 and 405 south of Dead Horse reopened yesterday. A release from the Department of Transportation says they are allowing groups of 30 tractor-trailers north on the single lane through the overflow area, then closing the road for inspection and maintenance before reopening the stretch for another convoy in the southbound direction. Priority is being given to critical cargo and supplies, which backed up along the highway and in Fairbanks during a nearly week-long closure. A state disaster declaration last week bolstered efforts to channel overflow from the Sag River off of the highway. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new transitional housing facility for female prisoners in Juneau.
It's a place that you get to be vulnerable for the first time. And of course, when you're vulnerable, it's part of your freedom.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Greenpeace protesters have climbed down from an Arctic-bound drill rig in the Pacific. The activists cited rough waters as the reason they abandoned their high seas adventure on Shell's Polar Pioneer on Saturday, nearly a week after boarding the ship, hundreds of miles from Hawaii. Also on Saturday, a federal judge in Anchorage granted Shell's request for a temporary restraining order against Greenpeace. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason ordered Greenpeace to stay more than half a mile from the Polar Pioneer and Shell's second rig, the Noble Discoverer. The judge declined Shell's request to have the order apply to all of the support vessels Shell hopes to deploy in its effort to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, though Shell may try to establish a buffer for its entire fleet if it seeks a longer-lasting injunction. The temporary order expires April 28th. The Bering Sea pollock fleet is about to face tougher restrictions when it comes to salmon. This weekend, federal regulators agreed to tie the cap on Chinook bycatch to the health of the Western Alaska's runs. KUCB's Lorne Rosenthal has more.
When the North Pacific Fishery Management Council first set up a hard limit on Chinook salmon, they set it in stone. Now, they'll check each year to make sure at least 250,000 salmon got out of the Bering Sea and back up the river system. Otherwise, the pollock fleet will lose a quarter of their Chinook limit. Council member Sam Cotton represents the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He introduced the measure.
At this point, any additional fish returning to those rivers improves the ability to meet escapement goals, which is necessary for long-term sustainability of the stock and the people reliant on that fishery.
After a string of subsistence fishing closures and historically bad returns, the council was under pressure to act. The final vote was unanimous, but there was still some disagreement. Council member Bill Twite of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife said the initial cut was too steep. He carried an amendment to bump it up by a few thousand fish. The pollock industry was almost universally opposed. Captains and fleet managers said they've started to see more salmon on the fishing grounds. Until they make it back to the Unalakleet, Upper Yukon, and Kuskokwim rivers, the runs will still look bad, and the bycatch limit will drop with them. Under those conditions, Donna Parker of the Arctic Storm Management Group said she believes the pollock harvest is likely to get shut down.
And you're going to shut it down without a benefit to rebuilding those rivers. It has been demonstrated this will not impact reproductive productivity of the rivers.
A clear estimate wasn't available from the North Pacific Council's scientist, in part because it's hard to say what happens to a salmon on its way upstream. The ecosystem still being researched. The financial impacts were an immediate concern. The Bering Sea pollock fishery is the largest in the country, and almost all of it is landed in the eastern Aleutian Islands. Frank Kelty is a resource analyst for the city of Unalaska, where pollock makes up well over half of the local tax base.
Every king salmon in that area of Western Alaska is important, but we could have a major impact to a fishery and communities in my area that I don't think is justified to change what we have in place now.
Over the last few years, trawlers have been getting fewer Chinook on accident, down to around 13,000 fish, or 2% of the total population. Using excluder nets and rolling closures to seal off the areas where there's the most salmon has made a difference. The North Pacific Council voted to expand both of those measures. They also increased the amount of pollock that's up for harvest in the winter, when bycatch rates are lowest for Chinook and chum salmon. They're a new priority, and they may not be as threatened as Chinook, but chums are still an important source of food and income in Western Alaska. Tribal leaders from the Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Association of Village Council Presidents spoke on behalf of the region at the council meeting. But Joe Garney was one of the few residents who managed to travel to Anchorage from his village just outside of Nome. Garney said things have changed in Teller.
For the last 12 years, I've not caught one king. So I've had a forced closure on my king fishing. And, I made the adjustment. I'm still here. I'm still healthy.
In time, Garney said the pollock industry and the people who rely on it will learn to make their own adjustments. The new restrictions on bycatch won't go into effect immediately. They still have to be reviewed by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and the North Pacific Council also wants a look to make sure the new regulations match up with their intent. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Juneau's transitional home for women who were recently paroled or released from prison is welcoming its first residents. KTOO's Lisa Fu toured Haven House last week to talk to a few of the women running it and the women who call it home.
This is the resident manager's room here. We have a bathroom. Of course, we need three bathrooms because we have up to 9 women, so women and bathrooms are a must.
Haven House director Kara Nelson walks through the 2-floor, 6-bedroom house.
And they're pretty standard rooms, but not too small. And everything is really nice, and we really want it to be, home-like, because it is their home.
All the women get a twin bed, closet space, and half a dresser. On the bottom floor, there's a washer and dryer, and a den with a TV, computers, and a big bookshelf. Upstairs, there's a living room, dining room, kitchen.
And then we have our amazing back porch, where I envision amazing barbecues.
Once a week, the women share a group meal, spaghetti and meatballs on this day, and Nelson says that's when it hit her. After years of working on the project, Haven House has finally become a home.
Just having everyone sit there, especially those women, they're very unique, and I feel like they were meant to be here, and yeah, I broke in tears right before dinner.
Haven House provides women who've left prison a place to call home for up to 2 years. It's a structured living situation where they have to come up with an individual action plan and get the support to follow it through. The women are expected to find a job, pay $550 in rent, and help with household chores.
It's a place that you get to be vulnerable for the first time. And of course, when you're vulnerable, it's part of your freedom. It's a place where you get to dream again. And there's people that are going to do whatever it takes to make sure what you need is going to happen. And so all they have to do is want it and follow the rules, you know.
The residents have to meet with Nelson once a week to go over their plan, and they must attend some sort of women's support, recovery, or Bible group. Haven House will be able to accept up to 9 women. Right now, 3 women live there, a live-in manager and 2 residents. 26-year-old Samantha Garten is one of them. She just moved in after spending a month at Lemon Creek Correctional Center for using meth.
Being here is probably the biggest blessing that's ever happened to me. I love being here.
Garten is working at Silver Bow Bakery. She wants to take online business courses and has hopes of being the catering manager. Her primary goal, though, is getting her 8-year-old son back in her life.
That was my biggest struggle in life, was giving my rights up because of my addiction, and I need to get better before I can have him. I mean, it's not going to happen overnight, so I'm taking it one day at a time.
34-year-old Delia Williams is working toward a similar goal. Her 12-year-old daughter lives in Haines with Williams' mother. Williams was the first former inmate to move into Haven House on March 17th. She works at the Juno Empire and goes to support groups and recovery meetings. For Williams, living at Haven House means accepting support from others.
For me, like, it was really hard to ask for help or to accept anything from anybody, just because, I don't know, it just made me feel bad. But just opening my eyes and feeling that support and lifting me up is really amazing.
Jennifer Brown says that's the beauty of Haven House. Brown is the administrative assistant and also a former inmate.
You know that you're not alone in an addiction, and you know that there's people going to be supporting you and showing you how to be sober and how to work and how to live and how to get things back, and just to give you the foundation that you need.
Brown says she's happy to work for people who want help and are ready for it. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Have you filed your taxes yet? Tax day is just a few days away, and the state's Consumer Protection Unit is warning it's seeing an increase in a new type of tax time scam, tax-related identity theft. That's where thieves use your personal information to file for a tax refund with the IRS before you get a chance to submit your taxes. Ed Sniffen is a senior assistant attorney general with the state's Consumer Protection Unit. He says the unit first started hearing reports of tax-related identity theft in 2012.
So what they'll do is they'll get this personal information on you, and then they will fake basically a tax return for you and try to get a tax refund in your name using your Social Security number. And a lot of times they won't be using your actual tax information, so it won't be necessarily your employer or your wages or your income. They'll make all that up. So it could be somebody with your name and social and claim you work for someone you didn't know you worked for or have never worked for, and they'll make up an amount of salary for you, and they will essentially fake a W-2 form in your name and submit that and try to get a fake tax return back. So then when you go to file a legitimate tax return, you know, the IRS has red flags going off. Hey, wait a minute, you've already got a tax refund. What's the deal? And that's when it's discovered.
So if it's already been done and processed and the scammers have already gotten the money back, then what happens to you who lost your identity?
Well, and that's the tricky part. It's not a good situation to be in, definitely. There's like any identity theft, there's a whole checklist of things that, you know, everyone recommends you do. You need to, you know, report the theft to local law enforcement. You should check your other financial accounts, make sure that, you know, you don't have any other credit cards out there in your name, you know, check your current reports and other things. But when it comes to dealing with the IRS on this particular refund, especially if they're telling you, hey, wait a minute, we're not sending you your refund, you've already applied for a tax refund and we've sent it to you, you can actually file a what they call a identity theft affidavit with the Federal Trade Commission, and then also work with the IRS to go through the process of figuring out that, okay, this was really a scam, and then eventually you'll get your refund back. That process is complicated a little bit. It's difficult, and it can take some time. So it's better to not be in that situation if you can, but if you do find yourself to be the victim of some kind of a tax refund scam, you're just going to have to go through the process. And the IRS actually has a guide on their website for taxpayers who have been victims, and they actually have a specialist unit that you can call, and they will work with you to kind of go through this process and work this out.
Is this type of crime increasing, and if so, why?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have seen an uptick in this kind of fraud in our office. We probably get, you know, 6 to 10 calls a week, especially this time of year during the tax season, of people who think they've been the victim of this kind of tax return fraud. And like I say, just in the last 3 or 4 years, it's been something that's you know, just come up on our head. Before then, we've never heard of it before. So it's definitely something that's relatively new. And it's getting a little worse. We speculate, we don't have any data on this, but it seems like the proliferation of these online tax filing systems has correlated with the tax refund fraud we're seeing. It's become really easy to get online and file, you know, with TurboTax or some other way your tax returns now, and the easier it is for you to do it, you can imagine, and the easier it becomes for scam artists to do it as well.
Ed Sniffen is a senior assistant attorney general with the state's Consumer Protection Unit. Easter was more than a week ago, but some Russian Orthodox Christians observed it yesterday. That's where Easter, or what they call Pascha, lands on the Julian calendar. There's a special treat that goes along with the celebration. It's not a chocolate bunny. It's called kulich. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on this tradition that's also become a native food.
Sue B. Lindoff has been making Easter bread for over 40 years. It's what she's known for.
I'm in such high demand, I posted on Facebook and I said, okay, I'm only making 2 batches of bread. I'm only making 2 tubs and no more.
In the kitchen of the Juno Clinkett Haida Community Council building, she sifts flour and sugar into a large mixing bowl, adding a dab of salt.
I will add nutmeg, cinnamon, vanilla, cranberries, the cran raisins, and the pecans.
After mixing in the yeast and cracking some eggs, she stirs the dough with a wooden spoon.
My dream is to invest in a big commercial mixer, but everything's still done by hand.
Lindoff measures all of the ingredients by sight. The whole process, she says, is intuitive. If you want to learn how to make kulich from her,
you have to come by me and follow the process with me, and people will look and say, well, how can you make something and not measure? And I thought, by the feel. And I don't mind sharing. I don't mind teaching, because to me it's like saving our traditions.
She grew up in the Russian Orthodox Church. Her family split their time between Sitka and Huna. Her dad was the only Clinkett priest ordained from St. Herman Theological Seminary in Kodiak. She says being a pastor's kid could sometimes be a burden.
My mom used to say, when they look at you, they say, there's that Father Michael's daughter. You know, especially if I was doing bad.
She says her parents were strict, but fair. They tried to protect her from the same discrimination they endured growing up. But it came at a cost. They refused to teach the Tlingit language.
My dad said, you will speak the English language, you will use the correct pronunciation, you will enunciate your words correctly. I do not want to hear no slang. He was adamant about that, but they didn't want us to suffer like they had.
Lindoff's father paid for his high school education. Her mother went to Wrangell Institute, which was a boarding school.
And of course, Tlingit was the first language spoken at home, and she used to have to sit at the head of the class and have a dunce hat on her head. She died never wearing a hat.
Although her mom didn't teach her how to speak Tlingit, she did show her the traditional way to make kulich.
My mom tasted my first bread dough and she said, yours tastes better than mine. And she never baked Easter bread again.
Russian Orthodox missionaries landed in Kodiak and the Aleutian Islands around 1780. The religion spread to southeast almost 100 years later.
They offered Christianity that was somewhat more tolerant of native customs and also very open to the use of native languages.
Sergei Khan is a professor of anthropology and Native American studies at Dartmouth College. He says the Russian Orthodox Church translated the gospel into native languages, like Tlingit.
And I think the fact that the Orthodox survived in Alaska also is proof that it was becoming a true native church during that period.
After Subi Lindoff incorporates the ingredients for the kulich, she sets the dough aside to let it rise for the next few hours.
You can go and get frozen bread dough, you know, or you could go to the store, but I don't think you're going to be able to find kulich in the store.
Lindoff compares making the bread to other native customs, like gathering herring roe. It's a skill she's passed down to her children.
When I do things like this, it makes me feel like it's part of the healing, like not being able to speak Tlingit because of that era where my mom and dad spoke it fluently and we didn't, and they didn't want us to. But I feel like this is part of that healing now. This is part of us going forward with the traditional ways and saving what we can.
She's excited to teach her great-granddaughter how to make kulich. She's 5 years old and learning to speak Tlingit in an immersion class. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lauren Rosenthal in Anchorage, and Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit, our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a nice night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Premier Dental Group, the Smiles for Life Foundation, helps fund children's charities and humanitarian work. Learn more at smilealaska.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Homestretch premieres on Alaska Public Media Monday, April 13th at 9 p.m. A film about three homeless teens braving Chicago winters, high school pressures, and life on the streets to build a brighter future. Following the film on Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m., will be a statewide online conversation and chat simultaneously engaging with panelists and community members about this film and homeless teens. Details at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.